Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Just Publics at 365 podcast series. I'm your host, Heidi Knobloch, and today I'm going to be talking with Juan Battle, professor of sociology, public health, and urban education at the Graduate Center of the City of New York. Professor Battle is the head of the Social Justice Sexuality Initiative, a project exploring the lived experiences of Black, Latina, Latino, and Asian, lesbian, bisexual, gay, and transgender people around the United States and Puerto Rico. During my interview with Professor Battle, I got to talk to him about the initiative, as well as the ways that it's being used by community members. So without further ado, let's get to the interview. So hi, welcome to the show. It's going to be so great to talk to you. I was doing a little research and, you know, a little digging on you, and I found that you were going to be the perfect person for this podcast.
Oh, thank you. Let's hope you feel that way in 30 minutes.
Yes. So if we could just start off, I know that your research has focused on sexuality, race, and social justice broadly. And so if we could just start out, if you could talk a little bit about that research and how you came to focus on that research.
Sure. Well, to anchor that question, I'll talk a lot about the Social Justice Sexuality Project, as opposed to just the broader research, because that could take us much more than 30 minutes. Far too often, whenever you hear the terms LGBT and POC, or people of color, in the same sentence, it's rooted in pathology. HIV, depression, you know, negative family or religious experiences, et cetera, et cetera. And so my colleague, Jay Pastrana, and I thought, wouldn't it be fun to do a project that was sort of the exact opposite? Instead of pathologizing the experiences of LGBT people of color, let's actually celebrate the experiences of LGBT people of color, and engage in a knowledge-based survey where the goal isn't necessarily to answer broad sweeping questions or look at disparities or anything like that. It's just your basic knowledge-based survey to see what's happening in the community and what are people's experiences, et cetera, et cetera. And so ultimately that led to the Social Justice Sexuality Survey, where in the end we surveyed about 5,000 people across all 50 states in Puerto Rico during the field period of 2010. And we, if you go to the website socialjusticesexuality.com, you can read more about the project and the data sets up there. The code book is up there. It will also be at ICPSR soon, at the University of Michigan, which is a data warehouse for a lot of public data. That it should be up there fairly soon. And on the website, socialjusticesexuality.com, we also have some executive summaries that are race-specific. So there's one executive summary for Black folks, one for Latinos, and one for Asian Pacific Islanders.
That's an incredible resource. How did you go about collecting all of the survey data? Kind of what did it look like on the ground?
Painstakingly. That's how we went about doing it. I had some of the most fabulous, wonderful, and dedicated staff and graduate students you could ever imagine. Like I say, the field period was all of 2010, from January 1 to December 31st. But the peak was obviously the summer, you know. In the United States, June is kind of gay month. And so we, if you include graduate students and staff and student and undergraduates coding the surveys, and people cleaning the survey and everything else, the project had about 175 people working on it in order to make it, to get it to where it is right now. And they were very dedicated people, and it was great and wonderful. And we gathered data from the places you might expect, you know, gay pride venues, et cetera, et cetera. But we also went to unexpected places where we, what I was calling race-specific spaces. So we went to the National Black Baptist Convention, for example. We went to, for Latino populations, come to find out, the rodeos, there's a gay rodeo circuit, but then also within the regular rodeo circuit, there's sort of a gay contingent. And so we surveyed there. We went online, and about 10 to 15% of the surveys actually came from online. We surveyed people that way. We did, as the surveys were getting completed, we coded them so we could make sure we were meeting our targets and our numbers. We knew going in we wanted to cover certain racial groups as well as certain age groups going in. We wanted youth, those who are 24 and younger, we wanted adults 24 to 49 or 25 to 49, and then older adults 50 and over. And so as the surveys were coming in, we were coding them. So we knew our demographic base and how we were doing. And at one point we realized we were fairly low for women of color over 50. And that became a challenge because we went everywhere we thought we could capture that group, but we're very unsuccessful. And a colleague of mine, a dear friend, Renee McCoy, she said, well, we being older lesbians, may not be in the venues you go to, but we eat and we know each other. And from that, we got a brainstorm. And so we started contacting lesbians in different locations who we knew through our social networks, inviting them to have dinner parties and telling them that we would pay for dessert, provided that before dessert, they handed out the survey and then put them in FedEx boxes and sent them back to New York. And that was a very effective way to meet some of those numbers. And so it got creative. But as far as going out to the locations, graduate students were the survey field agents, and you know, they got on planes and developed relationships with community-based organizations and local areas before they got there, and went to events, collected surveys, and brought them back to New York, and we got them coded.
That's really incredible. So were you interested in this as a graduate student? Did you get, when did you kind of think, oh, this survey will be, you know, this is where I need to go?
Oh, no, long after I was a graduate student. The survey, it came into thought early 2008. Again, based on conversations I was having with Jay Pastrana and Tanya Rawls, who's a bishop at a church in Charlotte, North Carolina. We were sitting in my office kicking around ideas, and we thought, you know, we should, you know, do this, and what would it look like? And then, of course, it just got so big, it got its own gravitational pull, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger. And raising money was a challenge. Because if you remember in fall 2008, that's when Lehman Brothers went down and the economy plummeted. And there became this challenge over raising money. The budget for the project was $1.3 million. And everyone was like, you know, now is not the time to try to raise money. And my response was, you know, there's not no money, there's just less of it. And so, you know, one has to try harder. And thus we did. And it was much harder than I thought. But as a matter of fact, the largest check we got was for about $250,000 from the Arcus Foundation. Everything else was small donations. You know, I spent all of 2008, 2009, not all of it, most of 2008, all of 2009, and practically all of 2010 raising money. But we did it. In the end, we met payroll, everyone got paid, and the survey got done.
The research on Black sexuality has been pretty sparse.
Correct.
You know, and mm-hmm. So was this survey, you know, a big boon to collection of data on Black sexuality, specifically LGBT?
Well, I would hope yes. but keep in mind, it wasn't just Black, it was also Latino, mm-hmm. as well as Asian Pacific Islander. So we knew going in we wanted to focus on a broad swath. And we also knew that there were certain areas that we wanted to make sure got covered in the survey. And so we dealt with political engagement, we dealt with sexuality and identity around race and sexual orientation and gender, we dealt with spirituality, we dealt with family. So it was a broad range of experiences we wanted to capture in the survey. The survey itself had about 105 questions, a fairly comprehensive document. And so we knew we wanted to definitely contribute to that literature. And what was most important for us was that we were not interested in talking about disparities or pathology, which actually made it significantly harder to get funded. Much, much harder. Mainly because, you know, the big dollars are for that sort of thing is at NIH. And I've been fortunate to have gotten NIH funding before, as well as National Science Foundation funding. And in all those cases, of course, they wanted you to either study some form of pathology or compare them to white people or straight people. And my feeling is we know a lot about white straight people already. They're lovely people, but I just wasn't interested in heading up that study. So,
yeah. So if we could now kind of talk mm-hmm. about how people have used the study, how mm-hmm. you've seen people use the study, and then also your engagement with the research that you've done in a wider kind of social justice mm-hmm. purpose, I guess. So the first question, how have people used the data? Have you seen people come to the site and getting those executive summaries?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. People have come to the website and gotten executive summaries and have provided feedback. 95% positive. The biggest complaint that we hear is that because we have those executive summaries that are race specific, and there are people who want them ethnic specific. And, you know, my response is, and people in hell want ice water. I mean, everybody has a whole host of wants in life. But the data's up there, and I encourage people to go ahead and, you know, download it and go for it one way or another. So how is the data being used? It's being used in a multitude of ways. One, obviously, there are several academic publications coming out of it, which is no surprise. You know, we're an institution of higher learning. That's what we do. Another way the data is being used is through public dissemination efforts. Probably one of the more impactful ones I found was we partnered with a whole bunch of organizations going into it in the first place, but then we also partnered with organizations in disseminating the data. And so the National Black Justice Coalition, for example, organized a event on Capitol Hill where, and I didn't know this at the time, but apparently all the legislators on Capitol Hill have someone on staff whose job it is to deal with race issues or LGBT issues. And sometimes it's the same person. But either way, that group of staffers has an affinity group that they've sort of formed together. And so the National Black Justice Coalition partnered with that affinity group and had an event on the Hill where this I did a presentation and shared with them about the data, what it did, political implications. One of the things that was very clear, because we got this, we pulled our sample from all 50 states and Puerto Rico. So for everyone who was there, it was like, you know, this population is in your district and this is their experiences and this is what's going on. So that was rather impressive. Something else we did was we partnered with a bunch of local community-based organizations to help us gather the data. One of the questions we asked in the survey was, what is your zip code? And so the respondent would give us their zip code. And then on the back end, the community-based organizations, they weren't necessarily interested in sort of the national story. They were oftentimes interested in very local stories. And so they would give us their zip codes, and we could basically put together sort of a mini report just for their specific catchment area. One of the questions we would ask, matter of fact, one of the first questions on the survey was, how far do you live from an LGBT organization? And so there were certain organizations that we worked with that were surprised that people in their zip code didn't realize how geographically close they were. And it helped them almost do an evaluation, if you will, of the clients that they serve. And they got rich data that was specific to their area and didn't cost them a dime. And they particularly liked that. And so we've done that for about 25 or 30 organizations throughout the country.
Wow.
That well, it's actually fairly, the hardest part is setting it up the first time. But then once you set it up, once you get their zip codes, you just pull the zip codes and do the exact same runs again. And just give them the all they want is just what I would think of as top line data, like frequencies and that kind of information. So it sounds like more work than it actually is. You know, once you set it up the first time, then you just swap out zip codes, and you get the same information. So that's how the data, I think, those are probably the biggest ways that it's being used. You know, the other thing that I like to yeah, because I talk about it obviously quite a bit, and I've been fortunate to have been asked to come to lots of places to do presentations. And there is sort of the counter narrative that our data is showing. You know, there in the world there are stories, sort of narratives that exist. One of them is that the African American community, as compared to other communities, is more homophobic. And there's all kind of hypothesizing as to why, because of the black church, because of conservative family, et cetera, et cetera. And so we actually asked some questions on the survey to kind of try to tap into that. And we found, what we find is consistently across the board, when you're asking LGBT people of color themselves, and you're asking them about, you know, how much is homophobia a problem in my neighborhood or in my community, et cetera, there are no racial differences at all. Not only that, we find that the African-American community within our sample is statistically significantly much more religious and spiritual than their counterparts. And so if the black church was indeed this horribly homophobic place, you would think that, you know, LGBT black folks would be running in the opposite direction. But indeed, they're not. And both in their own spirituality, we have questions measuring their spirituality, like God is important to me, how often do you pray, et cetera, as well as specific questions around religious participation. How often do you actually go to religious institutions? And we find that they are much more frequently, much more likely to go more frequently than their non-African-American counterparts.
Wow. Are there any other kind of, you know, myths that are dispelled by the data?
Well, to me, that's the biggest one, that sort of that counter narrative about how homophobic the black community is. Among the surprising findings, you know, things that I found that were just like, you know, I kind of, nothing I found surprised me as far as the importance of certain variables. What surprised me was how important they were. So with Latinos, for example, when you're looking at any practically any outcome you could think of, whether it's health or happiness or whether they're out or not or anything like that, no matter what your variable is you're looking at, the variable that explains the most for Latinos overall is the family variable. You know, how close they are with their family, the family importance variable. That just eats up the variance. And as a statistician, which is what I am, a sort of a number cruncher, it is just amazing how powerful that variable is, such that if that is in place, then all the other outcomes are positive and fine. But it's a double-edged sword, because to the same degree that having a positive experience around family leads to all these wonderfully, wonderfully positive outcomes, well, the opposite is true. So if the negative is if you have a horrible family experience, then all the other variables come out negative. And so the importance of family is really, and this is in direct comparison, not mind you to white people, but to other people of color who are LGBT. I mean, so it's already, you're cutting that, you know, pizza slice a little thin anyway. And so to find something that large is pretty impressive. For the black folks, it was family and spirituality. And so my running joke is, you know, for black folks, I guess the opinion is, as long as mama don't mind and Jesus don't mind, I could care less. And so that's pretty much, you know, and again, those variables are pretty much eating up all your variants. That's where your story lies.
Wow, that's great. Mm-hmm. One thing I want to ask you, and I know that what you mentioned in the beginning is, you know, we specifically didn't want to do something that addressed pathologies, mm-hmm. but this seems to have a lot of implications for public health, and I know that you've mm-hmm. written a lot about public health. So could you mm-hmm. kind of talk about some of the public health implications, or, you know, maybe the steps that public health could take to address some of the issues that, you know, you saw sure. in the study?
One of the things we found, the biggest public health story, there are lots of public health stories in there, but because we asked questions about, you know, do you have a regular doctor, your experience with your regular doctor, were you out to them, and what was that experience like, et cetera, et cetera. So there are a lot of public health questions in there. But the one that I thought was rather interesting, one of the first questions we ask very early in the survey, we ask, what are the three most important issues facing you personally? And it was an open question. People could write whatever they wanted. And then about two questions later, we asked, what was the most important question facing your racial or ethnic community? And they could write whatever they wanted. On the first battery of questions, what's the most important thing facing you? And they could write whatever the three things they wanted. You know, the economy was obviously a big thing. Discrimination was a big thing, but not based on family, but just discrimination and other. Could we code it that separately? So certain things sort of bubbled up as being within the top three. What was not present was HIV. That was not present. However, when we asked the community question, it was present. And so there is this sort of disconnect, which I think is worth noting. And that is that the public messaging, especially to African-American LGBT folk, the public messaging around the importance of and prevalence of HIV is clearly working. What's not working is how it then shows up in people's individual lives. So it's sort of seen as, yes, that's something Black LGBT folks need to worry about, but even though I am Black and LGBT, I don't have to worry about it. It's sort of their, whoever the they is. And so making that transition, if you will, from the macro to the micro, from the institutional to the individual, you know, there is where the messaging, there's a breakdown that's worth specifically addressing one way or another. I think another possibility might very well be, and this could be true across possibly all races, there's no way for us to know, because we didn't ask, we didn't submit HIV as a variable and they got to pick from it. They came up with that on their own, the respondents did. But, you know, maybe there's just an attitude in general that, you know, HIV, because it is no longer a fatal disease but a chronic one, it just isn't ranking on the list of things to be overly concerned about one way or another. But there clearly is a disconnect that I think that public health officials should pay strong attention to.
I guess the last question that I want to ask you mm-hmm. is, how have you personally been using this research to kind of reach beyond the academy? So either how you've used it in talks to community leaders or talks to community organizations, or how that's created, this research has created connections between you and different community centers. Are different community centers coming to you and saying, we saw your research and we really need to learn more? Mm-hmm. Then a kind of tack-on question there would be, is anybody asking you for more and different research? Are they saying, you need to do this kind of mm-hmm. research because this is what we need?
Mm-hmm. You asked several questions, and I answered all of them as yes.
Okay.
No, the answer is yeah. No. Yes. Yes to everything. It has made connections with other people. I mean, I've given talks and rather diverse, everything from religious institutions to colleges and universities, community-based organizations, after-school groups, a varied and sundry of different organizations have asked me to come and talk about the data and talk about the project. We partnered with Dr. Marjorie Hill, who is the executive director and CEO of GMHC, which is the largest AIDS organization in the United States. And they have something every year called the Latex Ball. And so for the Latex Ball, there were thousands of people there, literally. And we got a couple extra dollars together and put together a supplement just for that particular event. So in addition to the 105 questions that was already on the survey, we actually had an insert with a whole bunch of other questions because we knew there'd be a bunch of young people there. We had a lot of questions on mobile technology and the role and importance of mobile technology. And actually, Professor Jesse Daniels headed up that effort. And so we gathered the data there, and then we presented for them that information. I've been asked to do, you know, it different, bigger, better. Last February of not 2012, but 2011, I went to the University of the West Indies, St. Augustine, and did a series of lectures there for a couple of weeks, talking about sexuality in this project and social movement theory and other things as well. So there is, you know, clearly an interest in it, and I'm all for having people use it. And, you know, of course, now 3 years on the back end of it, if I were designing a survey, I myself would do it a little bit differently, as a matter of fact. Right. But, you know, but that's how knowledge works. You know, as I say to my graduate students all the time, you know, their job is to make my research obsolete.
Well, thank you so much. It was great having you.
Thank you.
Well, that was this week's episode of the Just Publics at 365 podcast series. Join us next week for a conversation with Margaret M. Chin about her work on Asian American immigrants in New York City's garment industry. Just Publics at 365 is a project of the Graduate Center CUNY, located at 365 Fifth Avenue, where you will find the life of the mind in the heart of the city. Just Publics at 365 is funded by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.